Hi, welcome to Eyes on Southeast Asia, the premier podcast on foreign policy, security, and economic issues on Southeast Asia, brought to you by Foreign Policy Community of Indonesia. And today we're going to have a interesting discussion with Professor Richard Hedarian. He is the upcoming and famous policy wonk from the Philippines. Welcome to Eyes on Southeast Asia. Good to see you.
As always. As always, I think we've been talking about this podcast thing for a while. I didn't know you already had it set up. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, let me begin by first asking you if you can tell our audience about yourself, about your academic career, and how did you become such a policy wonk?
Yeah, thanks again, Dina, for giving this chance to introduce myself to our Indonesian friends. I actually grew up in the Middle East. I'm now actually reaching out to you guys from the Middle East, right? So I've been circulating in Dubai and Turkey and Tehran in the region for a while now. So I spent around 10 years of my life in the Middle East before moving back to Southeast Asia and the Philippines, where I'm born. My mom is from the Philippines. Incidentally, my mom comes from the same ethnic group as the Marcoses. I'm sure you're familiar with the Marcoses of the Philippines, if not the Dutertes, right? So I can speak also the language of the North, the Ilocano language. That's my background. And then, of course, I studied in the Philippines, in the University of the Philippines. And then I started writing quite consistently over the past 10 years. I think I clocked in around 2,000 articles over the past 10 years. Writing first on South China Sea. South China Sea disputes really was really my obsession. You know, I spent my childhood analyzing the Persian Gulf, Iraq War, you know, so when I came to Southeast Asia, you know, one of my personal passions was to make sure in my own little way that the South China Sea doesn't become the Persian Gulf, right? This kind of a gulf of separation, right, between a northern civilization and its smaller Southeast Asia, southern neighbors, as in Iran and its Arab Gulf neighbor. So South China has really absorbed me over the past 10 years. And then I approached this in a very eclectic way. I mean, Dina, you should know this very well. You're kind of a Renaissance man yourself. You know, I've been a journalist over the past 10 years. I've taught in universities, including full-time faculty in places like the La Salle University, and also did visiting scholarship in different universities around the world. And then, of course, I am also an author. I've been writing quite consistently on Asian geopolitics. My latest two books were on Duterte and Trump, because I've tried to see the intersection of populism and geopolitics. I think the two are very related. I think there have been so many good books in political science on populism and many good books in international relations. But what I've been trying to do over the past 4 or 5 years is to bring them together. And as I joke to our good friends, Donald Emerson in Stanford, our very common good friend and an Indonesia expert, I said, I'm kind of like a GWF Hegel, you know, that 18th, 19th century German thinker who kept on writing the same book over and over again and tried to perfect his ideas, you know, about the region. So there is a common argument running through all my works over the past 10 years, thousands of articles, 4 books by myself and numerous chapters. And I think the fundamental argument I always want to make is this, that there is agency, that even supposedly smaller countries, we can shape our destiny. We can become not fully captains of our destiny, but we are not helpless. That even if we are among larger countries like China, US, among others, we can do a lot to shape our own national destinies. And also, we have to get to know each other better. I think it's sad to see that Filipinos or Indonesians know more about US or even China than each other, even though we're just next to each other. We don't, I think, even have direct flights. So I think this kind of solidarity building among ourselves, that's also something that has been driving in me. In short, have passion and enthusiasm. Be almost obsessed with what you do. And then just work really hard. I think writing is very, very important. You just keep on writing and practicing until you get it. And gladly, that got me, you know, sufficient amount of exposure and good networks like you yourself, you know, over the years. So have faith, work hard, and really be enthusiastic with what you're doing. See it as a vocation, not just a career, not just something to make money. You can make good money, of course, if you're good, but it's really a vocation and passion. And again, I can also see that in you, Dino, as you make Southeast Asia and community building Southeast Asia a personal passion. I think we really need people like that. And I'm glad to have made friends like you over the years.
Yeah. Thank you. The feeling is very much mutual. Let's talk about your president, President Duterte. And, you know, I see him as an interesting politician, interesting president, and also interesting foreign policy actor. I want to ask you, how much does he have ownership of ASEAN issues? Does he see himself as an ASEAN leader?
Yeah. Well, Duterte is really unique in the most unique sense of the word. I mean, all populists are unique in their own way, right? I mean, President Jokowi is kind of a populist of his own. I was a fan of Jokowi in the earlier years. I really followed his career. I followed the career of other populists around the world, Hugo Chavez, of course, Donald Trump. All of us have been paying attention to him. Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey, Modi in India. But in many ways, Duterte is quite unique, especially in the Philippine context. I think he's the first national leader in the Philippines I've seen who has openly rejected our alliance with the United States and questioned what was considered as sacrosanct. I mean, I think for Indonesians, it's hard to understand it because Indonesia, you have a long history of non-alignment, non-aligned foreign policy. You know, balancing is something very embedded in your national psyche since the days of great leaders like Sukarno. We don't have that. In fact, in the 1950s and 60s, our top diplomats were arguing with, you know, Sukarno and other leaders in the region that our future is with the West, not with the Soviet Union, that the third world should somehow ally with the first world against the second world. And of course, in some ways, the Philippines was proven right when Chinese invaded India, and because Nehru was one of the pillars of the non-aligned movement. And we can talk about the history. But the point I'm making is this, is that the Philippines, you know, is really, it's more like a Latin American, you know, Americanized country than many of its Southeast Asian neighbors, right? I mean, it's easier for me to relate to Mexicans than Malaysians, you know, as a Filipino. Mm-hmm. And our relationship with the United States has almost gone unquestioned for more than a century. Even if U.S. actually stole independence from the Philippines, because as you may very well know, I think the name Rizal is quite commonly used in Indonesia. Rizal was a Filipino national hero who fought against the Spanish colonial powers. But the problem is that the Americans helped us and then they hijacked our revolution and colonized the Philippines for 50 years. And then since then, the Philippines has been more or less an unquestioning ally. And I can tell you, Dino, this is not based on just some reading just newspapers. I work in the Philippine government. I advise multiple administrations, yes, including the current administration in various capacities. And I could see in the past, there was essentially this assumption that American interests and Philippine interests are perfectly aligned. So there was not much of a questioning of American foreign policy, even in private sometimes, I would say. Duterte changed all of that. I mean, Duterte is kind of like a Hobson petty tyrant in Davao, you know, who was loved by many of his people. He turned Davao from some sort of a Nicaraguan El Salvador, a civil war infested place in the 1970s and 80s, to kind of a mini Singapore in the Philippines over the past 20 years. At least that's his economic and political order achievement. At least that's his claim. But the other thing with Duterte is that, you know, he was influenced very much. He was a close friend of the founder of the Philippine Communist Movement, Joma, Jose Maria Sison, who's based in Netherlands. He was a very good friend and still a very good friend of the leaders of the Moro National Liberation Front in the Philippines, including Nur Misuari, right? Mm. So as someone based in Mindanao, where United States has been maintaining military bases, conducting counter-terror operations, Duterte was really outside the mainstream Philippine politics, right? He was someone who was more in tune with leftists, with communists, with more national liberation kind of ideology. And by the way, he was a student during the Vietnam War era. So he's really a product of 1960s, 70s ideologically. And anti-American sentiment is very much in his system. Then, of course, there were political reasons why he's an anti-American, or personal reasons for that matter. There were a number of incidents that happened in Mindanao, including Davao, whereby Duterte, you know, accused the United States of doing mumbo jumbo stuff, you know, including through its intelligence networks, the so-called mirroring incident in 2002. Then he claims, we're yet to confirm that, I've been trying to confirm that, that once when he was coming back, I think from Colombia, a country he supposedly studied their war on drugs, he had to pass to LAX, I think. And then there he faced discrimination for not supposedly having visa or something, although he had a diplomatic passport. So he felt he was personally insulted also by Americans. And this is a guy with a very, very big ego. He has a very big sense of himself. And he looked at the Philippine elite, not as just a bunch of liberal softies, but he saw them as stooges of America. So when he came into power, he didn't have much of a background in foreign policy, barely traveled around the world throughout his years of mayoral stint in Davao. But once he came into power, he said, out with all of these American boys, we're just going to do this very different. And the way he's doing it is like how Sukarno was doing it in the 50s and 60s. I mean, it's fascinating. He's really a product of a bygone era, right? His rhetoric, it has this non-aligned movement kind of tinge to it. I think Jokowi has had a good relationship with President Duterte. He's really a president, a person from a completely different era, right? In a country that is among the most Americanized in the world. So that's really fascinating to see. And as far as Duterte is concerned, he had great relationship with Chinese businessmen, with Chinese Filipinos. A lot of them are his top advisors, including Senator Bongo. So his exposure to China was much more benign and positive compared to that of America, which is almost the complete opposite of what you will hear from mainstream Filipino politicians who see America as the ultimate ally and knight in shining armor of the Philippines, and they see China as the ultimate communist enemy. So that's where Duterte is not only from a bygone era, by Philippine standards perhaps, but is from a parallel universe. And the fact that he made it to the presidency is also the product of perhaps social frustration with the kind of liberal oligarchy that the Philippines has been ruled by for the past 67 years. So people said, we want something new. And Duterte is, ironically, an old person who provided a new ideology and way of doing politics, unlike any Filipino president, not even Marcos or other strongmen in Philippine history were like him. So I think that's where he's definitely unique in Philippine history and revolutionized the Philippine history by questioning what was supposed to be sacrosanct, our alliance with the United States. Mm.
Yeah. Well, what has happened to the triangular relationship between Philippines, China, and United States, especially after Biden has come to power now? Do you see him? I understand that Duterte didn't get along very well with Obama and with Trump. So what will happen under the Biden administration? Will there be a warming of relations?
Yeah, I mean, this triangle has been something I've been writing on for the past decade or so, quite consistent. And it has gone through some major shocks and shifts over only two decades, right? So if you remember during the Arroyo administration, actually she happens to be a distant cousin. She's kind of like a great aunt of mine. During the Arroyo administration, I'm just being transparent, right? during the Arroyo administration, the Philippines began to adopt what political scientists called equibalancing or equilateral balancing strategy, right? Which is quite close to what you guys Indonesians have been doing for forever, right? So she would be nice to the US and try to maintain the defense alliance. But when the Bush administration criticized her, especially when the Philippines pulled back from the so-called coalition of willing in Iraq, she visited China. And then the Chinese premier Wang Jiabao visited the Philippines. There were a lot of contacts with Hu Jintao. So what did she try? It was try to balance between these two superpowers to create more room for maneuver for the Philippines. But the relationship with China went so wrong on so many levels. There was a joint development agreement that was negotiated that was kind of seen as unconstitutional and was done in secrecy. And that is still haunting the Philippines. The joint maritime seismic undertaking of 2005, which kind of lapsed in 2008 and 2009. With Vietnam and China. Then there was the NBNZTE, this ZTE of China invested in the Philippines National Broadcasting Network. That went bust big time because of corruption scandals. Again, I'm sure Indonesians are familiar with this. And then there was the North Railway Project of China, which again also went bust. The bidding procedure was declared unconstitutional by the Philippine Supreme Court. So I think Arroyo was the first Filipino president to try to play this kind of Duterte game, right? Maybe we can be friendlier to China, get more concessions from both sides. But it failed big time. So Aquino comes in, and quite similar to Mahathir 2018 and in the elections of Sri Lanka in 2014, Aquino run a good governance initiative and platform. And part of that platform is criticizing China. And it didn't help China that since 2009, China has also been aggressive in its claims in South China Sea. There were a number of incidents in 2010 and 11, including harassment of Filipino energy exploration activities in 2011. So Aquino comes in kind of anti-China. Again, interesting thing is that the Aquinos, they have Chinese background themselves. I mean, they look very Chinese, as you can see. So you have an ethnic Chinese or partly ethnic Chinese Filipino president becoming among the most anti-China political figures on earth, right? So much so, by 2013, after the Scarborough Shoal crisis in 2012, Philippines became the first country to take China to international arbitration over the South China Sea disputes. By 2014 and 15, Aquino was visiting Japan right and left. And in his one of his speeches in the Japanese Diet, he effectively likened China to Nazi Germany, that China should not be appeased, we should push back against it. So you can say by 2015, Philippines and China, this was the most toxic bilateral relationship on earth.
I remember that, yeah.
At the same time, the Philippines became the number one promoter of not only Obama's pivot to Asia, but also Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's efforts to make Japan a defense and security player, not only an economic player. So you have a liberal democratic leader supporting a less liberal, kind of a revisionist Japanese prime minister who wants to make Japan a kind of a pillar of stability. This was the kind of not only a triangular relationship, you also have Japan coming into the picture, right? By 2015-16. And then boom, Duterte comes. He becomes the antithesis of the antithesis, right? So if Aquino was antithesis of Arroyo, Duterte became antithesis of Aquino. His argument was, hey, this is a foolish fight. Americans are unreliable. And I actually kind of agree with Duterte. Obama was unreliable. Where the hell was America during the Scarborough Shoal crisis? What was Obama saying when the arbitration award came out in July of 2016? Americans were playing it very, very, very safe, right? And then it didn't help that Obama picked a fight with Duterte. I mean, again, you know, we appreciate Obama for many reasons. You and I'm sure you also like Obama very much in many ways. But the reality is that Obama, when it came to the Philippines, he took the realliance for granted. And I know for a fact that when Obama visited Saudi Arabia, you know, when they asked, what are you going to do there? He was not going to say, oh, I'm going to go there and show the Saudis on the rest. That's not what Obama would say. Obama said, we have a range of interests with Saudi Arabia. And then towards the end, he will mention human rights. But that's not what Obama said when he was asked, what is he going to do when he's going to meet Duterte during the 2016 ASEAN summit, right? This is a summit whereby there's also a meeting with superpowers, including the United States. So this was a meeting in Vientiane in Laos. And Obama, during a press conference, effectively said, I'm going to lecture Duterte to get his human rights situation under control because of the extrajudicial killings, the drug war, and Duterte's, of course, incendiary rhetoric. And I think that was sloppy diplomacy, especially if you're a lame duck president, right? So Duterte, well, he sensed it. He's a lame duck president. I have a fresh mandate. I have approval ratings of 90%. Who are you to question it? So during a press conference in Davao, I mean, Duterte, again, is unique. He gives press conferences at 11 p.m. He's very nocturnal. He's a taxi driver at night. I mean, he's really your consummate populist. So during one of these press conferences, he was pushed on that speech by Obama, by one of the American journalists, and Duterte just lost it. He cursed. Yes, he cursed. He used a certain Filipino word that I rather not use here. the initials are P and I. And then after that, it really went ugly with the United States. So when Trump came in, Trump managed to stop the hemorrhage by building strong personal rapport with Duterte. But as far as the U.S. Congress, U.S. national security establishment, U.S. media is concerned, Duterte was beyond the pale. And Duterte also knew that. That's why he never bothered to visit a single Western country for an official visit in the past 5 years. He's the only Filipino president who never visited the United States in an official capacity. And I don't think he'll ever with the pandemic right now and his term ending within a year from now. So under Duterte, his argument was this: Americans are unreliable. How dare they to lecture me, who has this democratic mandate? Who the hell is Obama? And by the way, Trump kind of likes me. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to try to have a reasonable relationship with Americans, but love from a distance. I'm going to downgrade a lot of our military activities with Americans. That's undermining my relationship with China because, as Duterte said during one interview ahead of his presidential election victory, he said, I want China to develop my country. That's effectively his statement. Again, I think Jokowi has made similar arguments in Indonesia, but the way Duterte said it, he made it very clear that he sees China as the developmental savior for the Philippines. And then he made it clear that if you're nice, in fact, to quote Duterte, if you are, quote, meek and humble with China, you're going to get Chinese mercy. So his argument was that if we don't push the Chinese on South China Sea, we downgrade our security relationship with the US, the Chinese will invest in the Philippines big time. And guess what? It'll be nicer to us in the South China Sea. But this is where, Dino, things get ugly. There's no indication whatsoever that that worked. That's even a bigger failure than Aquino's reliance on America. So Aquino over-relied on America, and now Duterte over-relied on China. So we see this wild swing whereby over the past 4 years, things got worse in the South China Sea, not better. More militarization and more what I call militiaization. China is using militia forces to harass other countries. Again, you should know that in North Natuna Sea, but it's even worse in the Philippines. In 2019, a Filipino fishing vessel was sunk by a Chinese militia vessel, a suspected Chinese militia vessel. Almost 22 died. And then, Dino, just to end on this point very quickly, there is, as I said, 4 years, there is zero Chinese big infrastructure investment in the Philippines, and Duterte's time is almost up. If that's not a blunder, tell me what is a blunder. And by the way, China promised the Philippines huge COVID-19 vaccines last December. They only arrive in February and few thousand, and they're not even safe enough for Duterte and other old cabinet members, including the health secretary, to take it. So if that's not a strategic blunder, right, of Duterte-esque proportions, I don't know what is a blunder. So what I can tell you is this: the past 20 years have been the most exciting, most humbling, and most tragic period in Philippine foreign policy. And I think we're still on the learning curve as far as our strategic culture and strategy towards the great powers is concerned.
Richard, I understand you're about to produce a book on ASEAN and China, right? And I look forward to reading that. I think it's going to come out at the end of the year or next year. Can you tell us two or three key takeaways from your book? Yeah.
Yes. So the working title is China's New Empire. So in that sense, it's going to sound like you're usual stuff. Oh, China is the next superpower. We're going to live in a Pax Sinica. Oh my God, China is going to take over. But I think the interesting thing is in the subtitles. In the subtitle, you're going to see words Southeast Asia and struggle for autonomy in the 21st century. You see, again, I've done book reviews. I've been interviewed for many books on China, Southeast Asia. Good friends have written, I think there were at least 3 books in the fourth quarter of last year alone on China and Southeast Asia. So when I was talking to, you know, publishers, and of course my publisher is going to be Melbourne University Press, inshallah, I said, this is going to be different. Don't worry. I mean, first of all, it's going to be someone from the region that's going to write it, right? And the fact that I spent 10 years in the Middle East and other regions of the world kind of also gives me both an outsider and insider view. So I'm both Southeast Asia in all parts of the world. But I think similar to you, Dino, I've also spent a lot of time in other regions of the world that gave me this kind of outsider perspective so that we don't fall for our own kind of internal myths and stories. Now, my other argument is this. My problem with lots of books, with all due respect to our good friends, is that they talk about Southeast Asia as if this is 19th century Afghanistan being fought over. Again, no offense to our Afghan friends, but this is like people talk about Afghanistan in the 19th century when the Russian Tsarist Empire and the British Empire were fighting over Central Asia, right, for influence in Central Asia. So I think I'm not really comfortable, first on a personal level, with my region of 600, 700 million people and several trillions of GDP being compared to some sort of a bunch of puns on a geopolitical chessboard. I think that is frankly insulting in many ways, but it's not about that. I think it's just deeply inaccurate. Indonesia is a G20. Indonesia is the largest Muslim majority country. It's the third largest democracy in the world. I think Indonesia alone is a major middle power and will be an even bigger player in the world in the coming decades. But this is not just Indonesia. Philippines has 108 million people. Vietnam has 100 million people. These are going to be trillion-dollar GDP economies in the coming decades or so. So ASEAN, everyone says, oh, ASEAN is a middle power composed of small countries. That's not true. ASEAN is, as I put it quite controversially, is a small and medium enterprise with no human rights charter. That's what ASEAN is. It's just an organization. But ASEAN represents a number of countries which are solid and robust emerging middle powers, not middle powers themselves, right? So everyone talks about Quad, but I think as Rory Metcalf and some of our good friends have mentioned, I think what we need is a squad, right? Which involves Singapore, Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam, many of key countries within ASEAN have a lot to say. So what I try to do in the book is to show the power of agency of quote-unquote smaller countries, which happen to be not so small, and the resistance to China's empire of economic and ideological influence on so many levels. So again, if you look at the journalistic policymaking and sometimes even academic literature, it's a very realist perspective, very simplistic. You know, what China, like a kind of an anthropogenic China does to an anthropogenic Philippines. But we all know that, you know, countries are not just composed of a leader. There are multiple veto players. There are multiple stakeholders. There are multiple levels of contestation. I mean, in Philippines alone, I mean, just look at the Philippines. President Duterte says, "I love China." The next day, the foreign secretary and defense secretary lambast China, right? That's only within his cabinet. Now, look at the Philippine media. Look at the Philippine civil society. They're very different in their orientation vis-a-vis Duterte. And by the way, the Philippines, as a liberal democracy, still kind of a democracy, power is not just with the president. The president does not have unilateral power. In fact, my contention is even in non-democracies like Vietnam, when you have massive anti-China protests, that influences the calculation of the communist regime in Vietnam. And then you have hybrids like Singapore, like Malaysia, among others. And then in countries like Taiwan, which I'll also cover. So what I do in the book is I look at this cow tongue, right? Starting with Hong Kong, Taiwan, Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, Vietnam. So how are these countries resisting China's influence on multiple levels? And what are the internal struggles in these countries to preserve national struggle and national autonomy? And by the way, I also try to show that Southeast Asian leaders, even Duterte, you know, they're not fools. You know, they also want to play this balancing game, this dynamic balancing game, this proactive balancing game. Sometimes they get it right. Sometimes they don't get it right. Sometimes they self-correct. Sometimes they have blunder. So it's a very fluid picture of agency versus, you know, Chinese, hegemony. That's what I'm trying to show in the book, which I feel will make it very different. So to use the jargon in IR, it's a little bit more constructivist, empirically constructivist approach. Because I try to also look at, because people also talk about China as if China is a monolithic power, as if, you know, there's a 100-year marathon to dominate the world. That's caricature. China itself doesn't understand itself. That's my argument. China's of today is a product of disruptive modernization. I think no one really understands China because it's so big and so complicated. So if you talk, you and I have had experience. We have talked to strategists in China, to policymakers. I had Chinese diplomats coming to me. I was in Hainan in 2019, just before the pandemic. You know, they were asking me, tell me about the region. What do they think about China? You know, you could see that even the Chinese are trying to figure out their place in the region. What are other countries thinking? So when you're ruling a kind of a modern empire like China, and you're going through this this massive economic boom and disruption, the idea that you have a fixed set of interests, I think, is nonsensical because China is still figuring out its place in the world. And the Chinese statecraft is flexible and fluid and it's dynamic. There's nothing set in stone. We saw how things changed from Mao to Xi Jinping, Mao to Deng Xiaoping, Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping, and yet it can still change. So the other argument I'm making in this book is that there's nothing fixed and monolithic with China. If we play our cards well, China will treat you with respect and we can get the maximum possible good concessions from China. Because I also do not subscribe to this argument that China is kind of like a new revisionist evil power that we have to resist. I don't buy that. Even as a Filipino, I don't buy that. So for me, it's also, I think good friends like Hugh White in Australia, among others, have talked about hard choices, right, that we have to make, right, vis-a-vis China. My argument is China also has to make hard choices because it is dealing with a world that is more self-confident. We also have popular nationalism in Indonesia and Philippines. We're also going to resist and stand our ground. So it's a dialectical relationship. It's a constant negotiation between China and the world. And in the process, your interests and identity also evolve. So in that sense, again, to use the jargon in IR, it's an endogenous theory of identity and interest formation, which again, I think is far more sophisticated and reasonable than your classic realist simplistic way of looking at things. And by the way, liberal theories also didn't work, right? I mean, the presupposition was with growing interdependence and economic globalization, China is going to be more like us, more liberal, more democratic. Well, it didn't happen, right? So for me, the mainstream theories of IR, which are indirectly reflected in media headlines, indirectly reflected in policymaking lexicon and discussions, I think they just don't explain it properly. And that's why I feel a more constructivist approach is a more effective and accurate way. And that's what I try to show in different chapters. So one chapter is about poison shrimp, right? How Lee Kuan Yew strategized Singapore's position vis-a-vis China and US. One chapter is about the Philippines. The title is, Are We Slaves of China? When a Filipino fisherman criticized Duterte for saying pro-China things during the harassment of Filipino fishermen. In the Indonesia chapter, I used the President Muhammad Hatta's, Vice President Muhammad Hatta's words, rowing between two rocks, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's what Indonesia has been trying to do for decade after decade, sometimes better, sometimes not. So I look at the to Suharto, to SPY, all the way to Jokowi, and now the second term of Jokowi. And then Vietnam, the title is Stab in the Back. So I look at how in the early 20th century, I mean, when we talk about Vietnam, we always say, oh, Vietnam, China, 1,000 years of animosity. What many forget is that Ho Chi Minh, the founder of modern Vietnam, is actually Chinese name, Ho Chi Minh, right? He who enlightens. Ho Chi Minh was trained partly in Canton, China, right? He was supported by Mao and the Communist Party during the earlier anti-colonial war against the French. But things went wrong in the 1950s when the Chinese essentially abandoned the northern Vietnamese when they wanted to push for unification. By 60s and 70s, they were already at war, right? In Cambodia, over Khmer Rouge, and border war in 1979. So actually the relationship was bad, then went super good, then went super bad, and then now it's somewhere in the middle. So that's also the other thing that I'm going to show in the book. So it's going to be really a both long journey history, a little bit journalistic, because I don't want you to sleep when you read my books. I want to make it a little bit more exciting. But the first chapter is really pure theory, exactly what I discussed, why a constructivist way of understanding China's influence in the region makes sense. And the last thing I would say, Dino, sorry, I'm saying a lot. Last thing I want to say is that do not underestimate America. It is true that America is in relative decline, just relative. I mean, the term that Paul Kennedy used in the 1970s and 80s quite correctly. But that doesn't mean that just because we're entering a post-American world, it's going to be a Chinese-dominated world. America has allies. Its allies are not 100% reliable. But even if Australia, Japan, South Korea are 50% reliable, US still has a network of allies which China doesn't have. I always ask, who are allies of China? I mean, you and I, Dino, we were in North Korea a few years ago. I don't hear the North Koreans praising the Chinese as much as we anticipated, right? And even the Russians, the supposed friends of China, they have their own worries in Siberia. So who else? Pakistan? I mean, again, if you're familiar with Pakistan, you'll know that it's a much more complicated picture than the rhetoric suggests. So China has no real allies to rely on, not even 10% reliable allies, right? Well, the US can still rely on Japan, on Australia, and new strategic partners like India, which is increasingly becoming post-Nehruvian under Prime Minister Modi in recent years. And then, of course, we see even the E3, the European three powers of Britain, France, and Germany. Even the Germans are becoming more concerned with what's happening here, and they're also flexing their muscles. I mean, you are one of the persons who are very aware of this, you know, the European interests also in this part of the world. So in that picture, I think we're entering what sociologists called a rhizomatic order. So I think one of the simplistic ways of looking at Asia is like power in Asia is hierarchical. So one day it was US, the next day it's China. My argument is that, that's very simplistic. Power is rhizomatic. It moves in lateral in multiple directions. Why? Because Asia is such a big, complicated, messy place. No single power can be an effective hegemon, right? There are going to be climate change or terrorism problems, Dino, that I think Indonesia, Australia, and Philippines can cooperate. And there's nothing that US and China alone can do to solve it, right? There are going to be technological disruptions that create all sorts of social polarization. Then again, China and US will be almost irrelevant when it comes to dealing with these issues. So if the hallmarks of hegemony is providing international public goods and enforcing certain norms, we're living in an increasingly complex and messy world whereby no single power can impose that. And in that rhizomatic world, not necessarily, we could face either a G0 world, as some experts would put it, or a much more unilateral, flexible regimes of cooperation whereby neither US or China calls the shot entirely, but us middle powers, middle countries have more room for maneuver. So it's also prospective argument. It's a prospective book about the coming order in Asia in the coming decades.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like an interesting book, Richard. I look forward to reading it. And, about your point that China doesn't have allies. You know, and I agree with you that the United States has a lot more allies, and because they have a military alliance systems and so on. But isn't it true that China, that's not China's game. China does not go around trying to form military alliances. Their game is about to engage countries in economic cooperation and develop greater political influence, if you will, and go into the social cultural space, the soft power engagement and so on. And in that sense, they have gained a lot more in Southeast Asia compared to the United States, right? Do you have any comment on that? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the running argument, and it's legitimate in many ways. I don't disagree with that. I mean, that's why the title of the book is China's New Empire, right? This new empire is not your, it's not your typical empire like Roman Empire or Persian Empire. It's more like the new tributary system, right? Similar to what China had in the medieval times or pre-modern times, whereby, you know, the Sultanate of Sulu or Sultan of Java should come and kowtow to China in exchange for recognition of China's superiority and a certain degree of flexible strategic alignment, you'll gain access to China's economic largesse, right? So when I say China's new empire, it's essentially the new tributary, semi-hegemonic primacy that China enjoys in this part of the world. When you look at trade flows, China has completely displaced Japan, right? And it comes from, and in terms of investments, China is also gaining more influence. Soft power, well, we kind of can argue about that because I don't think Chinese cinema or, you know, or culture is anywhere as attractive as that of America. I think the competition is so lopsided in favor of the United States. And by the way, I don't think COVID-19 is helping Chinese soft power very much, including their sloppy vaccine diplomacy, right? Promoting in your face that we're giving you vaccines for the very pandemic that came from China because of their mismanagement of the crisis. So I have big doubts about the Chinese soft power part. But yes, through economic influence, they have built a semi-empire, a kind of a new tributary system. No question about it. The title of my book recognizes that right in front. But to say that economic influence will more or less win you geopolitical loyalty, right, or deference, I think that's an argument that is increasingly being proven wrong, right? I mean, that's why I start with Taiwan, right? If you look at Taiwan, Taiwan's economy has essentially been absorbed by China's mainland economy over the past 20 years, right? And yet, look at the society. Sense of Taiwanese national identity has actually increased in recent years. You have a president like Tsai Ing-wen, who is essentially an undeclared pro-Taiwan, pro-independence Taiwan kind of leader, right? Although, of course, she plays her cards very well and smartly for understandable reason. But if you look at it, economic interdependence doesn't necessarily create geopolitical alignment. I mean, the best historical precedence of that is Kaiser's Germany and Britain, right? As you know very well, the great delusion of the late 19th century was that because Germany and England are going to be top trading partners. And by the way, their monarchies are cousins, for heaven's sakes, including cousins with Tsar Nicholas. They're not going to go to war. And yet, First World War happened. Because even in economic interdependence, there are asymmetries. And even if you have economic interdependence, identity politics will not go away. Geopolitical anxieties will not go away. I mean, one thing I love about Hegel, and I think Fukuyama used it very smartly in The End of History, is the idea of struggle for recognition, right? At the end of the day, we're not homo economicus. We care about dignity. We care about our national identity. And sometimes we're breached. We're willing to give up so much economic resources if we feel we're being insulted. If we feel our dignity is not recognized. My sense is China has correctly played what Antonio Gramsci, Italian thinker, centered war of position, like slowly and surly countries. I think the internet. So China has been playing this war of position game, slowly encircling countries, investing in them. I think there's a Chinese expression that eventually you'll be like a ripe fruit that will fall on my lap, right? I mean, that's the Chinese thinking. Mm-hmm. They thought it's going to work in Taiwan. Mm-hmm. It backfired big time. And I think it's also because China's played it sloppy. I think the way they have been behaving in South China Sea, the way they are behaving in North Natuna Sea, their mismanagement of the pandemic, their in-your-face vaccine diplomacy, over time, I think that can significantly undercut whatever economic and soft power influence they may have built over the past two or three decades. So in short, I think the argument that just because China's economic influence, it can win geopolitical deference, is kind of liberal argument. And I feel that's exactly what is being proven wrong in recent decades. I think that's what we're looking at. And I think, fascinating to see, I saw in Indonesia in your latest presidential elections was, there was not much discussion about Jokowi's infrastructure or economic development. Islam was a very big issue. Relations with China were a very big issue in your elections. So I think issues of identity are becoming more and more important in national politics of many of China's neighbors in ways that will make it very difficult for China to just essentially co-opt or buy whole countries with money, right? And by the way, Dino, we are all assuming, I'm not saying China is going to collapse tomorrow, but we're all assuming that China will just keep on growing 6, 7, 8% forever, when the reality is that China is becoming a high-income country soon, and it's almost inevitable that its growth will decline, and it will have to invest in social welfare, in pension, in an aging society. So yes, today we're all impressed with China. They have trillions of dollars for BRI. Well, let's see the money when it comes, because I don't see much of an investment. And I think as China faces more and more domestic pressures to create a social welfare system, to deal with the shocks right and left it's receiving, I don't think China will also have as much money to spare as it has been advertising over the past few years. So my argument is that let's not overestimate China's economic influence, as much as we have to recognize that, in fairness to China, over the past generation, they have really built an impressive amount of economic influence in the region. And of course, they are the most successful capitalist expansion story in human history, ostensibly under a communist regime, which is fascinating in itself. As for US, the reality is that, yes, US is no longer the hegemonic power it was in the 1950s and 60s for basic material reasons. It's no longer as economically dominant. Its military qualitative edge is nowhere where it used to be. But, you know, the United States has managed to shape the preferences and mindsets of a lot of countries around the region. And then there are many countries like Japan or Europe, European countries or Australia, you know, who value their economic relationship with China. But at the same time, they're also not blind to the hegemonic tendencies of China and its aggressive activities. And we saw that even under Trump, everyone was annoyed with US, but still, you know, the Quad was consolidating. And we see even further consolidation of the Quad under the Biden administration with the first inaugural summit and concrete initiatives for Quad to really help other countries in the region, especially Southeast Asian countries. So my point is, yes, let's not ignore the influence of China. Yes, America is no longer the hegemonic power it was, but that doesn't mean that the benefits and advantages that China has accrued over the past three decades is immutable, that it's not vulnerable. I think that those advantages are very vulnerable if China keeps on playing its cards so bad as it has been over the past few years. I mean, this wolf warrior diplomacy is already a kind of an alarm bell, right? I mean, I think Dino, you and I think we are used to see more sophisticated, more low-key Chinese diplomacy sticking to their script and all. And what we saw in Alaska Summit is the new face of Chinese diplomacy, right? Lecturing Americans on human rights, speaking out of script. I'm talking about Yang Jiechi. I mean, one of the most decorated diplomats in history. We're talking about Wang Yi, who speaks Japanese. He did a fantastic job as ambassador to Japan during the early and mid-2000s. But we see even these veteran diplomats are giving into this kind of a hyper-nationalist wolf warrior diplomacy. I don't think that's going to win China a lot of friends, and that's going to undercut a lot of the goodwill and economic influence that they gain. Because, I mean, just another country I want to look at is Britain, right? I mean, just a few years ago, Britain was one of the most excited countries when it comes to Asian development, the AIAB of China. They tried to bring in Chinese investments. Now, look at it. Suddenly, right and left, there are restrictions on 5G investments by China. They're deploying their aircraft carrier. So in short, it's much more fluid. It's much more reversible than many people presume. In short, China's new empire is vulnerable. As formidable as it is vulnerable, it's fragile. And if China keeps on playing its cards so bad as it has been in recent years, it's gonna lose all the gains of the Deng Xiaoping era.
Yeah. So, Richard, I agree with your point that economic closeness does not lead necessarily to geopolitical loyalty. And I want to underline what you said earlier about the importance for ASEAN to develop strategic autonomy, right? So my question to you is, and by the way, ASEAN centrality is premised on the ability to maintain strategic autonomy, right? So my question to you is, what do you think it takes for ASEAN to maintain its strategic autonomy, irregardless of close economic cooperation with A, B, and C, and so many factors going around. What does it take for ASEAN to be solid and to maintain its strategic autonomy?
At least on three levels, right? I mean, the first thing we have to recognize is that the ASEAN is not the ASEAN organization, as I mentioned a while ago. ASEAN as an organization has like few hundred bureaucrats, few millions of dollars of budget. There's not much that the ASEAN can do as an organization, right? There's just so much that it can achieve. Although, I mean, as someone who spent 10 years in the Middle East and other parts of the world, I can say that I'm a big fan of ASEAN. What we achieve among us ASEAN countries is nothing short of what IR scholars call a security community, right? The idea of use or even threat of use of war as an instrument of dispute settlement among Southeast Asian countries has become unthinkable, right? And we saw that very well during the SPY period when, you know, your former colleague, Prime Minister Netaragawa, did a fantastic job of pushing and encouraging Thailand and Cambodia to resolve their disputes through international arbitration. I mean, that's just fascinating. You don't see that in the Middle East. You don't see that in many regions of the world. In terms of that, I think we're almost EU level when war is almost unthinkable among Southeast Asian countries. We did a fantastic job of creating a free trade area in the ASEAN. So there are many accomplishments that ASEAN has essentially ticked the box over the past 5 decades. But my argument is that the ASEAN decision-making process is not really consensus-based, in Arabic, muafarat, but it's actually unanimity-based. Now, that unanimity-based decision-making process was fantastic when only 10 of us were talking with each other. But once bigger powers got involved, especially China became powerful as it is, then unanimity-based decision-making process became essentially a tool for dividing and conquering ASEAN, right? I mean, if you're China or any other great power, all you need to do is to pressure one or two countries and nothing will happen on a sensitive issue. Because unanimity-based, not muafakat, not consensus, but the actual decision-making process on sensitive geopolitical issues like South China Sea, that gives veto power to each member of ASEAN, almost regardless of whether you have a direct interest or not. I mean, honestly, I'm so Aristotelian in a sense that for me, the great injustice is treating unequal people equally, right? I mean, What is the direct interest of Laos and Cambodia in South China Sea? They have no direct interest. And yet they're given as much voice as Philippines or Vietnam or Malaysia, who are facing existential questions on South China Sea. So I think that's where ASEAN multilateralism has hit what I call a middle institutional trap. It's kind of like middle income trap, right? So the policies you use to go from a poor to middle income country, like, you know, China, cheap labor, manufacturing, low in manufacturing, that works only to a certain degree. I think the same thing happened to ASEAN. Unanimity-based decision-making process worked fantastic in the earlier years of ASEAN when 10 very diverse countries in Southeast Asia had to come together. Fascinating, great achievement. But now that we want to be an anchor or the driver of regional integration entire in the Pacific, it's not working because it's so easy for external powers to manipulate us and to pressure just one country or two and nothing happens. We see that on the Rohingya crisis in Myanmar, and we're kind of paying the price right now in the Myanmar. We saw that on South China Sea since 2012. So I think ASEAN on the multilateral level is reaching a kind of a deadlock. We need soul searching. Perhaps it's time to do some evolution. In fact, my argument, I'm a fan of ASEAN. Many people misunderstand me. They say, oh, Hidarian, what does he know? He's anti-ASEAN. No, I love ASEAN. That's why I'm pushing for reforms within ASEAN. Remember, not remember because we're old or you're old, Dino, but in the 50s and 60s, Dino, we were at war with each other, right? You had confrontasy, Filipinos with Malaysians over Sabah. My goodness, in the 50s, we were not too different from the Middle East. I mean, we were almost on the same level of, it was a mess. Then ideas of Mafilindo came, but some would say Mafilindo was also kind of an Indonesian-Filipino conspiracy against newly emerging Malaysia. But look at it, from that, by the late 1960s, we suddenly have at least 5 key members within ASEAN coming together and saying, you know what, we don't want to be part of this Cold War, this Seattle, this confrontasy, let's put that aside, let's work together. So that was the first stage whereby we went from a kind of a Hobbesian anarchy, right, confrontasy, to at least a semblance of common understanding on what we want to achieve as autonomous post-colonial nations. The second phase, you know, again, I'm sure you're very familiar with this. Again, you're very young, we're both young, but, you know, in the 60s, 70s, especially in the 80s, the next discussion was, okay, Thailand, Philippines, Indonesia, Singapore, we're all kind of, you know, we're kind of, how should I put it? we're not communist socialist countries, right? To put it simply. So what are we going to do with Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, right? These kind of communist Indochinese countries. Guess what? We resolved that too. By the 1990s and 2000s, these were member countries. And today, Vietnam is a pillar of ASEAN in ways no one anticipated in the 1970s when ASEAN was criticizing Vietnam for invasion of Cambodia, right? So that's the second reset we did in ASEAN. So two instances when we went above ourselves and imagined a new world and kind of achieved it. The third phase was the end of Cold War. Okay, Soviet Union is gone. There's no Cold War. What are we going to do? That's where we got very ambitious, right? We said, you know what? We're going to be the engines and drivers of regional integration, right? And that's where you'll see explosion of constructivist theories. Acharya and others are good friends. It worked, but with the rise of China, we saw also the limits of that, right? And then when Trump came in, you know, essentially we reset the deck. So my argument is that now we should enter our fourth reset. We also recognize the limits of ASEAN, right? Including this middle institutional trap. So just as we were able to imagine a new order and achieve it so successfully in the 50s and 60s and the 70s, 80s until the end of 20th century, why can't we have another reset in ASEAN? That's my argument. Because ASEAN history also is not monolithic. ASEAN is far more dynamic than many people recognize. So this is one argument. The second argument, as I said, is that ASEAN is not just a bunch of small countries. We are not small, especially if you're Indonesia or even Philippines, Vietnam, Thailand, right? And Singapore may be small in terms of size, but definitely it's not
they punch above their weight, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Perhaps their weight is not what's shown by their size, perhaps. It's a better kind of metaphor. So that's the second thing we have to keep in mind. Each of us are potential or actual middle powers who can be in some ways captains of our own collective destiny. And at the third level, just of course, there are many we can discuss, but third levels, things like what you, Dina, have been doing, right? I mean, what I love with our conferences, with our Russian counterparts, with our European counterparts, with our Japanese, South Korean counterparts, is that the world is not just US and China, right? Southeast Asia is not only about US-China competition. And if you look at it, you know, all of these other major powers, India, Russia, Australia, or European countries, or Japan, you know, they may be ally of one side or the other, or not ally of one side or the other, but all of them also want to help ASEAN because there's something also for them, right? For Japan, they're already a big infrastructure investor in Southeast Asia. They have an interest in prosperity. Australia is kind of our near neighbor, or increasingly seen as a near neighbor to Southeast Asia, especially like you guys. India wants to also carve out its own influence, and Europeans also have their own kind of interest. So what we need here is a dynamic, proactive, and multifarious balancing strategy. And that means, Dino, we need more podcasts like this. We need more educated strategies. We need a more sophisticated strategic culture in Southeast Asia. And that's why I welcome this podcast, because we really need to have a conversation among us. What on earth are we going to do in this new, brave, or new, crazy world? And that's where we need to have more conversations among ourselves, as ourselves, not just as pawns of the great powers or as helpless, supposedly small countries who are just trying to survive in this cruel, Hopchan world.
Yes. Well, that's why we call this podcast Southeast Asians for Southeast Asia. Maybe the last one or two questions, Richard. The Quad now has been lifted to a higher level by the Americans by virtue of the leaders' meeting that they just had recently. Do you think that this uplifting of Quad to a new level will intensify competition with China in Southeast Asia? And will this make China more nervous, feeling more encircled or more, contained? Yeah.
Yeah, Dino, I've used the term Asia NATO, right, for Quad. And of course, I got bashed for it, understandably. But I meant it in a very specific way. I called it an Asian NATO with 21st century characteristics, right? Kind of to use the Chinese way of putting things. Because obviously, even NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is not the same thing it was in the 20th century, right? We're not talking about fixed, hierarchical, organizational military alliances. I don't think even in Europe that's working anymore, right? But definitely in Asia, that's not going to work. The Seattle didn't work. Other initiatives in the Middle East didn't work. But I think the Quad is kind of like a flexible, ad hoc, minilateral version of the kind of military blocks we had in the past, but short of an actual military alliance. And on one hand, it reflects shared concerns about what China is doing in Asia and beyond. It's also, as I said, it's a reflection of, let's just be honest, growing frustration with the ASEAN. I think, you know, a more pessimistic way of looking at the Quad is this. The big boys saying, okay, you guys, you had your chance, but no, you're not doing your job. Okay, let us take charge, right? I think that's a message that a lot of us in ASEAN are taking. In fact, I remember very well, my previous book title was Indo-Pacific. It was very hard for me to get reviews from some of the ASEAN diplomats because they didn't want to use the term Indo-Pacific, right? They were very sensitive about it. Like, oh, that sounds so Cold War. That sounds so Trump or whatever, right? So I think there is a kernel of truth that the consolidation and institutionalization of the Quad is also a reflection of marginalization of ASEAN or frustration with lack of real ASEAN centrality. Now, again, Indonesia did a fantastic job, tried to push back, you push for the ASEAN outlook on the Indo-Pacific. But just to be frank, if you read the AIOP, it's more like a defensive, you know, kind of a document which tries to assert ASEAN centrality, but that's an aspiration so far. So I think there's definitely that kind of a worrying thing about a Quad. But again, nothing is set in stone. I'm a believer in good change. I'm a believer I'm a believer that we can make the most out of even difficult times. My sense is the Quad can also enhance the ASEAN, especially on the minilateral level. My recent articles are mostly about why it's time for ASEAN minilateralism rather than multilateralism. So while it's true that on the multilateral level, unanimity-based decision-making process, not really consensus or more of that, has kind of paralyzed ASEAN's ability to effectively respond to Myanmar crisis in the past or now actually over South China's disputes over the past decade, on the minilateral level, if the Quad countries reach out, do capacity building with frontline states, with pivotal fulcrum states within the ASEAN, I'm talking about Indonesia, Philippines, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Singapore, right? If these five countries can come together and have more and more minilateral cooperation with the Quad powers, I call it Quad Plus arrangements, then I think we can strengthen our ability as a whole in Southeast Asia to preserve a degree of strategic autonomy. I mean, let's just be honest. At the end of the day, China will care more about the foreign ministry statement of Indonesia or Philippines than the kind of tepid, watered down statements of ASEAN, right? I think the Chinese are very sensitive to what individual key countries in the ASEAN can say. And if we, together with Quad countries and European three countries and other like-minded countries, can coordinate our strategies and diplomatic position, not like in a new Cold War way, but in ways that signal to China that we're uncomfortable with it, there's going to be resistance, maybe you want to revisit your decision, I think we can achieve a better optimal outcome down the road. The term I used here is a Goldilocks strategy that combines deterrence and engagement. I completely disagreed with the Trump administration's confrontational deterrence-focused strategy towards China. I think it was lopsided and very problematic and very risky. At the same time, I also do not believe in just schmoozing with China, no matter what they're doing on the ground, including the forever code of conduct negotiations with China. That is not also working. What we need is an optimal Goldilocks combination of right amount of engagement going hand in hand with right amount of deterrence. And I think a minilateral cooperation between key countries in ASEAN and the Quad together can put requisite pressure on China for them to rethink their policy. So I have hope in ASEAN. I also have hope in China's rationality, provided we engage in an effective constrainment strategy. We cannot contain China. They're too big and too important. In fact, recently I argued that the real Cold War was not Soviet Union and US. Soviet Union was never really a match for US. Their economy was too small and their military edge was overrated, right? We got to know that sooner than later. But China, I think this is the real competition to the US. So you cannot contain China the way we could contain Soviet Union, because Soviet Union was not really important to the global economy the way China is and will even be more in the post-pandemic era. But we can constrain China with the right amount of diplomatic, military, economic pushback, but also engagement, because China is an indispensable stakeholder in the Indo-Pacific order. I believe that. So that's where my argument is not your straightforward black and white. It's really 50 shades of argument, right? That's what I have. It's hard for people to appreciate or understand it. But I think, you know, after 10 years of thinking about this almost obsessively, I think this is really our best shot, a constrainment Goldilocks strategy that combines engagement and deterrence, and it involves key countries within the ASEAN, Quad, and other like-minded powers to jointly tell to China, we can have a better relationship, we can have a better world, but please reconsider some of your policies if you really care about also your influence and place in the world.
Richard, this has been a fascinating discussion. As always, we always hear something new from you, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
This is your host, Dino Patijalal, and I hope you enjoy and learn a lot from our episode. Don't forget to share and subscribe Eyes on Southeast Asia on your favorite streaming platform. Follow FPCI social media for more information about our activities, upcoming events, and programs. See you there.